Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here.
We talk a lot about health, but your gut is where it all begins. A balanced gut can improve everything from your digestion and energy to your immune system and even your mood. That's why Simproof, Ireland's number one for gut health, is such a game changer. And right now, for Black Friday, you can get 25% off their live and active bacteria supplement. Each daily shot is packed with billions of friendly bacteria that actually reach your gut alive and start working to restore balance where it matters most. No capsules, no powders, just a refreshing, water-based drink in four great flavours. Take it first thing each morning, 10 minutes before food or drink, and start feeling the difference. A healthy gut supports your whole body, so don't miss 25% off Simproof's 12 and 4-week programmes now at simproof.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Vodafone Business. With cybersecurity solutions from Vodafone, your business can hack off the hackers. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we're heading behind the screens to hear about the realities of parenting in the digital age. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram @JessKellyNT. I do hope you're well and you're having a nice week. This week has been incredibly busy. We did our great gadget gift guide on the Pat Kenny Show on Friday. It was fantastic. We had present ideas for every price bracket and for everybody in your life. If you missed it, you can listen back on the Go Loud app. Just search for Pat Kenny, or you can watch it on YouTube. We were on the internet. So you can head to our social channels @NewsTalkFM or go to YouTube and search for News Talk, and you'll see me struggling and fumbling to do some of the devices. But sure, look and sure, listen. It was live, but it was great fun. So all of that is there if you are on the hunt for some gift ideas. But today on the show, we're continuing our series looking at parenting in the digital age, the challenges and the opportunities that exist. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk this week here in Ireland and indeed in Europe about the right age for children, young people, to be on social media. Should it be set at 16 rather than 13? How do we stop children under the age of 13 from getting access to social platforms? There's so much that's going to be spoken about and then hopefully done to keep our young people safe online. But last month I was in Cork for Behind the Screens in partnership with CyberSafe Kids. And I was joined by the fantastic Dr. Coleman Nocter and Claire Daly, who is a board member of CyberSafe Kids. And we talked through some of the issues, some of the safeguarding measures that we can put in place, and then how you navigate this with your children. And I started by asking Coleman if there was such a thing as a silver bullet solution.
No, there's definitely not. And I suppose you'd extend that to there's no one way to parent either. So mm-hmm. I mean, regardless of that, I mean, you have to think about a child's temperament, a child's developmental age in terms of not all 12-year-olds look the same. There again, there are some 13-year-olds where I would have very little concerns about their online activity. There are 17-year-olds I'd have grave concerns about their online activity. So it's not something that we can apply a kind of a blanket rule to. And it's interesting that, you know, 13 has become the kind of age that we see as, you know, producing the phone for the child. And, mm-hmm. and it's interesting to find out where that came from, because that's not from any scientific research. That's from Carphone Warehouse and Tesco Mobile, who say, you know, it's really hard to pick a confirmation name, but it's not hard to pick a phone, so come down and get one. You know what I mean? Yeah. So from that point of view, that kind of arbitrary age around secondary school, confirmation, whatever it might be, there's no basis for that in science or in research. But what we do know is that readiness is important, and readiness involves a child's maturity. It involves their ability to make good decisions. It's their ability to ask for help if they're struggling. All of these factors, it's a complex thing to decide on whether a child is ready. And again, buying a child a phone is like getting a puppy. You know, the work only starts there. Do you know what I mean? In terms of that's not the end of the discussion, it's the start of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose how you start and how you manage to introduce that in, because what you're doing is you're creating a relationship with technology. It's not, it's like a relationship with food. You know, you don't want to be turning to it when you're in a period of discomfort. And we all have different relationships with food. Some of us take it or leave it. Some of us, you know, will tuck into the tree press when we're tired, whatever it might be. And so you have to almost imagine that what you're doing is when you're buying a phone is you're creating a relationship, and you have to oversee how that relationship develops. And that involves kind of keeping an eye on how your child is managing that, and also how you're managing it in terms of your surveillance, supervision, etc. But that's a long-winded answer to your question. No, there's no specific age, and every child is different.
Yeah, and I think we'll get to the question of buying or giving a child a device in a second, but there's a lot of fear for parents from the second a child is born that any exposure to a screen is going to damage them indefinitely.
Yeah, there is. And any, I mean, bar a big T trauma, which is a big event in your life, it's repetition is how habits are formed. Do you know what I mean? So it's when something is done excessively. Like I would have parents say to me, when my child was three, I came in and they were like drawing with a marker on my wall, and I went, oh, what are you doing? And I thought I traumatized my child from having that conversation. That's not how you traumatize a child. It's repeated patterns of behavior over time that tend to have those kind of impacts. But when we talk about when should you introduce a child to technology, and a child is introduced to technology from birth, do you know what I mean? And there's a concept at the moment, a few years ago, it's called technoference, right? Which is this idea that even in those early years of bonding and feeding, where the mother, there's a beautiful saying, Donald Winnicott says, when there's no language, the mother holds the child in her gaze. So the look is the thing that makes you feel safe. And now the child has to compete with a screen for the gaze of the mother. And I know that's an uncomfortable conversation to have, but it is a new dynamic into a very kind of primitive experience. And that in some ways is an introduction to technology, because the child is already competing with the screen for something that they need. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But from the point of view of it is about excessive use, it's not about one-offs, it's not about... And this is why there's no one-size-fits-all answer, because is allowing a child to use an iPad for 10 minutes while you have a shower the same as putting an iPad in front of a child every time they're distressed? They're completely different things. So when we think about usage, and again, it's probably another topic, but screen time is not a good measurement for a child's relationship with technology.
Yeah.
You know, we don't judge a child's diet by how long they sit at the table. Mm-hmm. We judge it by what they eat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so from that point of view, we have to be much more nuanced about how we understand children's usage. And there could be a child who'd use a device for a half an hour and hand it back to you and run outside. And there's a kid who could use it for 15 minutes and you're prizing it from their hands with a big argument. And that's the relationship with technology is different. So one child will need one intervention, and another child would need another.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And I think that's why what you said at the beginning is so important, because every child, you could have, like, I have three siblings, and you will not meet four more different people than me and my three siblings. And every child is different. How we respond to, whether it is, you know, food, an emotional movie, technology, whatever it is, we are all so different. And that obviously starts at a very young age. So it does come down to each individual situation. But Claire, I want to refer to the CyberSafe Kid report that was published in September, because there were some fascinating insights in that. Because as Coleman mentioned, there's a lot of focus on the age of 13, because, you know, that's when a lot of the platforms will allow children onto them. That's when, you know, very often kids are going to secondary school or get their first device. But we also got some insight from that report about kids who are under the age of 13, who are both engaging with technology and have access to devices of their own.
That's right, Jess. So the Trends in Usage report, it surveys children ages between 8 and 12 in one bracket, and then the next bracket is 12 to 15. And it's very interesting to see, particularly the very young children aged 8 to 12, we see that 93% of children in that age category have their own smart device, which is a huge proportion of children in the 8 to 12 age bracket. Interestingly, as we were talking about smartphones, the number of children surveyed with smartphones had actually reduced. It's 39% this year. And we think a lot of that is to do with this grassroots movement that we're seeing with parents who are delaying buying the smartphone and pledging to do so within their primary schools.
Mm.
So we are seeing the reduction in smartphones. But of course, the rise then in tablets and games consoles. But when you talk about social media, the same age bracket of 8 to 12-year-olds, there's a huge proportion of them who are on 13-plus social media and messaging apps. So the 71% of 8 to 12-year-olds surveyed are on those 13-plus messaging apps or social media. 60% on YouTube, 29% on WhatsApp.
Mm.
25% of 8 to 12-year-olds are on Snapchat from that survey, and 23% are on TikTok.
And you see, what's really interesting, and those stats are shocking, but what I find interesting, knowing little people in my life who are in that age bracket, is very often they want to be on them so that they can say to their friends in the playground or in the schoolyard, oh yeah, I'm on it as well. They don't necessarily want it for the same reasons why I want TikTok, which is to just numb my brain on the Lewis home from work. It's almost like having Pokemon cards or Pogs, which was cool back in my day. It's the modern equivalent of that, would be my read of it. Do we know anything? Are there insights or any takeaways of what the kids are doing in that younger cohort when they are on these platforms?
Well, I suppose worryingly, one of the things that would jump out of you, if you have a look at this report online, anybody in the audience wants to see it, you see that 77% of those children, they say that they can use devices in the privacy of their own bedroom, which is a huge number of children who are behind closed doors using these devices connected to the internet. And they said 63% of parents can't see what they do online, which is a huge amount. 16% of those children aged 8 to 12 were bothered. They said they were bothered by reports in relation to nudity or sexual content or contact in games and apps. So 16% of those very young children were bothered by the content.
And I think, Coleman, this goes back to what you were just talking about there in terms of the different kinds of kids. And if you can have a kid, you can have a device for an hour and, you know, do online colouring it in and then hand the device back, or that kid for 15 minutes who's obsessive and gets upset. How do you figure out what kind of child you have until it's too late? Like, do you have to give the device and then go, let's just see what you do here?
There's a rule of thumb that the more they want it, the less they should have it. In terms of, you know, I have three children. My eldest boy was disinterested in ever having a phone. Mm. And we almost had to got him one, and he spent more time in the mantelpiece than it did in his hand. His daughter from the age of 8 was dying to get a phone, and was kind of, she would take his phone off the mantelpiece. So we're kind of saying, I'm going to delay her onset more than him. Do you know what I mean? From that perspective. But it's interesting you say about having those platforms to be on those platforms. That same chap who was kind of got TikTok and things because other people had it, very soon became quite the TikTok user. You know what I mean? From the point of view of, and you could see the shift over maybe a 3 or 4 month period where the phone was spending less and less time on the mantelpiece and getting more. And again, I think that's the skill of the algorithm to try and hook you in by things. And I know what he watches. It's all gaming related, how to mod DSs and all this sort of stuff. Like, he's that's his interest, and it seems fairly futile. You know, there's nothing on there. And I guess he's a lad that I would think would have the sensibility to come out of stuff that he didn't want. There are, you know, there's young people who don't have that. They have a kind of a reckless intrigue about things and want to go deeper into things. And I've met those children in my therapy room many times who have stumbled upon something which led to something else, which led to something else. And it's almost like that idea of having no guardrails or safe rails when they're in that space that they can go after it. And again, I would say to parents, you know, the idea around having some surveillance over their content, and I know that's really difficult. In a handheld device, it's almost impossible. But to use an example, my kitchen looks like an internet cafe in 2005, right? Because there's PCs and PlayStations all along the wall. It's not very feng shui, but it allows me to keep an eye on everything that they're doing. So in terms of their gaming headsets, I hear their conversation. I can't hear the TV for their shouting, but I can still hear what's going on. And again, that's the labor of it. You know, if you're going to invest in giving children access to these things, you almost have to be the safeguard or the guardrail for it. And so there are certain children who will have that kind of normal reckless abandon. And you know, you'll find children, take snack foods or treats, right? There are children who have different approaches to that. There's the kid who, and sometimes the more restricted a child is from having chocolate at home, if you see them at the local 11-year-old's birthday party and they're gorging it, you know, so prohibition doesn't always
work.
Manage
you said
desire.
That to me years ago as well, of like there were two things that you said. So the first one was, you know, banning something or making something a taboo isn't the answer because it makes you desire it more. It's that thing of the parents who say, the example you gave at the time was, if you eat your dinner, you can have the ice cream. And then the ice cream became the goal. And that's sometimes not a helpful or healthy way to be. And the other point that you made, and it's kind of an uncomfortable one for adults in the room, is you equated phones as like a doady or a pacifier for us, the adults, because it gives us comfort. And the kids look at us and they see us being comforted by it and being happy or smiling or laughing or giving it all of that attention. And so the relationship and the association between moods and whatever it is, whether it is treats, ice cream, phones, that does matter, and the context and the conversations around it matter as well.
Yeah, I mean, the phone has a very emotional place in our lives. It's our diary. It's where we keep our pictures. It's where we keep our thoughts. So it's not just a microchip thing to make calls. Most people don't even use it for make calls. So from the point of view of you have an emotional investment in the phone, and some people's emotional investment in it is going to be much, much more intense than another's.
Yeah.
And from the point of view of each child being different, their sense of that intensity about how, like, say, for example, how they develop a relationship with sweet junk food or whether they have a kind of a blasé comes down to a quality. And it's an Irish quality. And it's one of the things I still would think is the most important thing is cop on. Right.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the definition of cop on is a child who can react proportionately to the event that's in front of them. So they don't get overly excited and they don't get overly devastated. And, you know, we use that in Irish terms to say that kid has a lot of cop on or that kid has no cop on from that point of view. It's almost akin to maturity. And almost that's the greatest indicator of readiness, is how much cop on your child has. Here's an example. If you want to give your child a phone and leave them free rein of that, ask, how would they manage their diet if you left them at home for the day? Would they go and make some veg and have some water and do that sort of stuff? Or would they eat Oreos and Weetabix? If they're Oreos and Weetabix, they're not probably in a place of readiness. If they would have the sense and sensibility to make those choices, then perhaps they'd maybe make good choices around usage as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's
because they're both regulation.
Yeah.
Regulating emotions or regulating appetite.
And also having the cop on to give the right answer to a parent as well and not say the
Oreos.
It's being smart enough.
And the savvy kid, yeah.
And Claire, one of the things that we spoke about when we were in Dublin was around the practical things that parents can do if and when the time comes to give them either a device of their own or access to a device on a more regular basis. And I'm going to talk through how to set parental restrictions in place in just a quick second. But can you just explain the importance of having these boundaries and guardrails in place? Because I remember being at a launch, I think it was a CyberSafe Kids launch years ago, and Leo Varadkar was there. He was a Taoiseach at the time, and he described the internet as the Wild West. And it always made me laugh, but it's kind of true. Once you're in, anything can happen. So how important is it to have boundaries and oversight from day dot when it comes to your kids and access to devices?
Yeah, so as we know from the surveys that children aged 8 to 12 are on these devices. So as you say, boundaries are crucially important, not only for that age range, but as they grow up and grow older and go into the teenage years, those boundaries, a lot of them can continue on. So one of the key ones is that there will be no devices in the bedroom at any stage, whether they're 8 or whether they're 17 and a half, there'll be no devices in the bedroom would be a key one, but also no devices in the bathroom as well. You say places where the child can be left alone with the device in a private area, it leaves the child quite exposed. So at all times, that would be one of the key boundaries. So then you're looking at, in addition to that, you're looking at, I suppose, having the device in a place, in a public area in the house. So in the kitchen, in the living room, where there's adults' eyes and ears around to monitor, to hear what's going on, to have a bit of oversight. And even as the child gets older, they still have that privacy, but also the parent is around, keeping an eye, keeping the temperature of the room in check. So that would be a key one. Also then when you're looking at boundaries, you're looking at, I suppose, what communication that you bring to your child around the device. So you're talking to them about etiquette online, safety online, you know, the same stranger danger conversations you'd have with your child when they're going out into the world. You'd have that with your child when you're giving them the device in an age-appropriate way. So 8 to 12-year-olds are very young, but also you'd have that communication with them and keep the communication open. So then as they get a bit older, hopefully that communication can continue in another more adult way. And then I suppose the other thing I suppose would you'd highlight for the child as well in relation to that netiquette piece is around cyberbullying and is around how you communicate with someone. The nuance is very different online than it would be when you're sitting next to each other in the classroom. The tone, the joke doesn't carry. So just be very careful. The sarcasticness, maybe the little jibe written down in communication, that's very different than when you'd say in a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, so I want to jump into cyberbullying in a second, but I just want to take a moment to talk through, because we asked parents in the room before they came in if they have parent safety settings on devices that kids have access to, and the majority said no. And this is a simple, small step, particularly if your kids are in the primary school level, that you can implement. You can even do it retrospectively. But if your child is on an Android device, so that is anything that's not an Apple device, essentially, Google Family Link is free and it is fantastic. It gives you a bird's eye view of what the child is doing. It lets you restrict access to certain apps, limit screen time, and also, you know, there's a few other bits of functionality if and you want them. But Google Family Link, completely free, very easy to set up. So that's worth doing. And if your child and yourself have Apple devices, the parental control center on Apple devices is very, very good. Like that, you can go in, create a little family group. You can restrict access to apps, in-app purchases, request a parental approval before they download anything. And again, this is stuff that's already existing on devices. It is free to use, very simple to activate. And while it doesn't solve the issue and the child can still be messaging and doing bits and pieces that you still want to have eyes on, it gives you that peace of mind. If they request to download a certain app, you have to approve it, and it gives you the opportunity to go and Google that app, read up on it. You know, CyberSafe Kids, their website, WebWise, the ISPCC, Parental Hub, they all have great resources to kind of give you a cheat sheet on what these different apps are. So that's one way that you can instantly take a bit of the power back and give yourself a little bit of peace of mind. And I do think it is worth having on any device that a child uses, because it just gives you a first line of defense. Again, it's not the be all and end all, but it does help. So Coleman, Claire mentioned there cyberbullying, which I suppose I'm reluctant to kind of go there straight away. Go on, what were you going to say?
No, I think we sometimes think about, like you were talking to the parental controls there.
Yeah.
And I think we sometimes think about the dangers of giving a child a phone as the cyberbullying, the grooming, the online gambling, those kind of headline issues. There's another issue at play that is important to remember. And that's, you know, having to send 70 Snapchat messages before you have your Cocoa Puffs in the morning.
Well, so this is the thing that I wanted to come to first, because my 10-year-old niece has a phone and she would very often be like your son and turn it off or put it up on the mantelpiece, because I've seen her get overwhelmed. Because she's getting notifications from her friends, and they're all nice messages. And it's like, what are you doing? Do you like my hair? Do you like my bobbin? And it's that intense thing. And a 10-year-old can't prioritize of, I can get back to that later after I've had my Cocoa Pops. It's the sense of urgency of, you're asking for me, so I need to give you the attention. And so that anxiety from a young person having a device really intrigues me.
It is, because the most stressful app that I have on my phone is WhatsApp.
Same.
Because I'm part of 100 parenting groups who there are things like, you know, anyone seen Paul's jumper, or, you know, this dress up day tomorrow, or come in as a book character, or whatever it might be. And it's ping, ping, ping. Or we'll do a collection for Brita. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. That sort of stuff. So it's the life admin involved in that. And, and there are groups that I can't leave, because if it's Coleman left the group, there's drama.
What a wagon wheel.
So from the point of view of, that's the stress, right? So even if we, like, we took away all the cyberbullying, cleaned up the internet, took away cyberbullying, took away pornography, took away everything, you'd still have a kid who's trying to manage, or still have a kid who will spend 9 hours watching cats on skateboards, right? Nothing illegal about that, nothing inappropriate about it, just a really poor use of time.
Yeah.
So while we can regulate the device, we also need to regulate human desire. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And trying to manage that. And when we enter a child, give a child a phone, we put them into that life admin space where they have to answer those things. We introduce them to a performative culture where images of themselves, or, you know, communicating through video, that sort of stuff. There's a great saying, when a child is born, they're born in what's called discovery mode. So they can investigate the world and they look at things and they pick them up and it's they explore things. And like a five-year-old, they'll keep saying, why? Because they want to know that sort of stuff. And as they get older, they go into defensive mode. And that's what will people think. I'm very conscious of what I look like. They become conscious of labels, what their hair looks like, that sort of stuff. And they move the dial from discovery to defensive mode. When we give a child a phone and introduce them to the world, that switch happens, right? So it's buying time before that happens, because you're the little person you were talking about who's getting overwhelmed by the messages is in defensive mode, not in discovery mode. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And while childhood is shrinking, we need to extend it as much as we can by allowing children to stay in discovery mode for longer. Does that make sense? And that is about trying to protect them from that life admin responsibility that comes with. And that's not going to hit they're not going to be headlines in the newspaper about that stress or that pressure. It's just that hum of anxiety that children live with all the time.
I had it when I was 10, and it wasn't because of a phone, it was because of Tamagotchi. I got
keeping
a Tamagotchi and I ended up bawling, crying, going into the sitting room and telling my mum and dad I couldn't deal with the stress, so they threw the Tamagotchi in the bin. But it was that thing of it beeping, it needs water, it's beeping, and it was only a little Tamagotchi thing, it wasn't actually real. Whereas I could imagine feeling like that, but tenfold when it's your friend in school and they might be annoyed at you if you don't reply to them. And
Snapchat streaks.
Yeah.
Like, that is the most stress-inducing
dynamic. It's a casino for kids.
Yeah, of course it is. And for anyone who doesn't know, Snapchat streaks is where you send a picture of a wall or a shoe and you send that back to me. And we do that every 24 hours. But if 24 hours pass and one of us forgets to send, the streak is lost. So you could have 300-day streak that's gone. And children become devastated by this. And, you know, you drop the ball on this and you're obviously not my friend. And it has huge cost or a dynamical cost to the young person in that I've spent more times talking in a therapy room about a Snapchat streak than I ever thought I'd wanted to. Do you know what I mean?
Really?
Yes, it's huge. More so now you can pay to reestablish this streak. You couldn't do that a few years ago. And so
what a good use of money.
So your 99 cent or whatever it is that you're using to reestablish it. But in the past, it certainly up to about a year ago, and it still is, and it's such a mind-numbing thing of taking a picture of your shoe, sending it to you. That would be stressful enough if you had one streak, but imagine trying to spin plates of 17 streaks that you have to keep in your mind. When is that 24 hours up? And so when parents take a phone off a child and she's going, or he's going, what? And they get really agitated about it, it's almost because their need to be on is 24/7, because if they drop the ball on that, there's a dynamic cost to it.
Yeah.
And we, like, if that was a toy, it would never be allowed on a shelf in Smith's or whatever it would be. Because Snapchat isn't a toy.
Yeah.
And we need to get our heads around that. But it is that spinning plates, trying to help manage the constant hum of expectation and pressure that you're under as soon as you own a phone. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've all done that thing of, God, I got that text message 3 days ago. I meant to text that back. And you pretend and say, I had it half written and I never
I did that today. Yeah, I did it here today.
But it's trying to keep on top of all that is difficult enough as a well-adjusted adult.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to do that, where the social demand to get back to you is way, way more intense at 12, 13 years of age than it is in your 40s. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's something that's come up in the survey that we did before the show. A lot of the parents in the room and who replied to the survey expressed concern around screen time addiction. Which the word addiction, when it comes to the age cohort that we're talking about, which is primary school children, is massively concerning. But when you hear what Coleman just outlined there with the Snapchat streaks, it's easy enough to understand how and why this could happen. Where and how do parents intervene in something like that, Claire?
It is very difficult. And I think, in addition to the Snapchat streaks, we're also seeing that an awful lot in gaming now. It's really commodified gaming insofar as if you're not on the game at 8 p.m. on Sunday, you won't get this special release or this special item. Or say if it's, you know, Fortnite, you won't get this skin. So the children are becoming more and more anxious to be on. Usually it's times outside of the boundaries the parents might have set as part of the gaming schedule in the home. Then they're having to say, can I go on this extra time? You know, and if they don't get on, it's a bit of a panic. So I think very similar to the streak kind of notion that the child needs that technology and it's feeding into that, that what the child gets back from the game, that endorphin, that release that the child gets from getting these rewards, essentially. Mm. And it is a real gambling type mentality that you're seeing in the child. And I suppose really what you're talking about when you're looking at the screen time, there is very good, parental controls in gaming that can limit the time. It's not always great because it cuts off the time in the middle of the game, which can be very distressing for a child. They could make them better and more intuitive and that this is the child's last game. But instead it just blacks out when the child is just going to win whatever the game is. But also in gaming is that notion that the game never ends. Whereas in olden times when we used to play and the Game Boys or whatever, you got to the end of Tetris or whatever it was, the game was over. Mm. But in the more modern games, there's no end point. There's no end to the game. It'll keep going while the child is sitting there. So it makes it really difficult to put in place those boundaries and say, you can only have an hour. And I want you to turn it off after an hour. Mm. I mean, for a lot of children, the hour goes by in the blink of an eye and they're still in the game.
And you see, that's difficult because the kids are obviously, for something like gaming, they're enjoying it and they're finding an outlet where they can be creative or they can be a bit destructive, they can connect with their friends. And so on paper, it seems great. But as you alluded to earlier, Coleman, it's the mood after the fact, or it's the shutting down and winding down to go to bed after the fact, that's probably the bigger issue, is it, rather than the actual gaming itself?
There's two issues. I mean, the gaming in itself is, there's some cognitive benefits to gaming and, quick reactions, that sort of stuff. Just on the point about the apps that shut it off, like I always say to adults, if you were watching your true crime series and they're just about to find out who the killer was and your kid came in and plugged it out.
Oh, I'd flip my head.
So it is more useful to kind of give time limits and say you have 5 minutes left or 4 minutes left and kind of build them up to that. Children don't have the capacity to cognitively regulate in that way. But from the point of view of the game itself isn't necessarily problematic. However, some of the exchanges through the chat and the headsets can be deeply problematic about, a child who's maybe lost a game on playing Rocket League or something and they hit the wrong thing. Some of the vile things that people would say to each other on that. Mm. And I've had lots of young people being told, go kill yourself and stuff like this because they've missed a shot and stuff. Mm. So the cost of that, while the communication and there's a lot of good in children coming together for a gaming experience, the experience can vary very much from a very enjoyable experience to a very deeply damaging experience as well. But the game itself, in moderation, isn't problematic. Mm. Do you know what I mean? But it's for those reasons, like the loot boxes and all these things that keep, like they're basically scratch cards.
Yeah.
That you could win this, you pay this, you get that. It's the gamification mindset is very difficult for children to, I suppose, manage at a very young age because you can get very much hooked into that. And it's a whole economy, the skin economy of buying skins for things. Like the idea of the metaverse, right? Yeah. Where we're all going to be avatars and we'll be sitting doing this in 5 years' time and you'll be all your avatars and we'll be avatars. And I can see people of my age going, oh, that'll never take off. But that's not for us. That's for children who've been playing Roblox and Fortnite through avatars all their lives. Yeah. So by the time they get to that level, it's going to be second nature to them. Mm. Does that make sense? And so the idea of what messages it sends children around gamification, around the addictiveness, around go to the next, get the next level, I'm not so sure they're cognitively or socially able to manage to regulate that for themselves.
So how do parents, because the parents in the room, like you probably all know this and you're living through this, that's why you're here. So what do you do as a parent? Do you go to battle every night and do you have the same conversations, or do you try and have a conversation away from a time when the gaming is happening and you talk about it and trying to reason with them? Like how do you approach it again with this age cohort of kids in primary school?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is pre-planning. So you have an agreement around how much time someone gets. And so that's an agreement made between the two of you and how many times. And so it's not coming as a shock and it's not arbitrary and it doesn't depend on what humor you're in, I have another hour or, you're turning that off now. So it's something outside of both you or the child in that way. I think from the point of view of you're trying to help them to self-regulate. And by doing that, I put it this way too, right? If you want your kid in over the summer at 8 o'clock at night and they want to stay out till 10, right? What you say is, come in at 8 o'clock, on time, no arguments, no rows, no, you know, on time, no, just no, no trouble.
Yeah.
We'll push it to 8:15. And if you come in for 3 nights at 8:15, no arguments, no rows, no fighting, we push it to 8:30. If you come in at, so what you're saying is the more you play ball,
yeah,
the more lenience you get, right? Having a technological device is not a right.
Mm.
It's a responsibility.
Yeah.
So you earn the right by showing the responsibility. So you need to give children an opportunity to show the responsibility that they can come off it and they can manage it. And as they do that better, they get more time. Does that make sense? So you're...
Yeah, but I just wonder for parents who, say you've got a 9 or 10 year old and they've had access to gaming and they know that they can play it for hours on end and they love it. But you, the parent, are realising maybe we have an issue here. Like, can you do this retrospectively?
It's much harder to close the gate than it is to open it slowly, right? So that is difficult. It's not impossible. But what I would be saying, and this is the hardest challenge, is to extend the phone or the game free time rather than reduce the game time. Does that make sense? So none of us, and it gets back to your point about role modeling.
Mm.
You telling your child to come off gaming while you scroll on Instagram for hours is you saying, eat up your porridge, I'm having a packet of crisps.
Yeah,
it just won't work. They won't see that as buy-in.
Yeah.
So what you do is you try and extend the times in the family where there's no gaming, over meals, for an hour after meals. We're going to have movie night. We're going to do this. We're going to put these places in. So the sacred non-tech spaces get larger rather than restricting the time that they have. Does that make sense? And what we have to do as parents, and it's, this is far from ideal, is we have to compete with technology. Because the dopamine hits and the nature of the flashy images and that, like, that's way more, like if you say, come off your device to do what? And you say, tidy your room, not going to work. Do you know what I mean? You need to have to offer something in addition to that.
Mm.
And children, especially primary school children, just love time. They love time with you. And whether it's building a fort with the cushions on the couch or whether it's baking something or whether it's doing something, that's as much of a dopamine hit as the game is. But we have to offer the alternative in order for them to entice them away from the screen. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's far from ideal, but it's, and that's where I say to you, getting the phone or getting the device is only the start of the labor because we have to compete. It can't just be restriction, restriction, restriction. And we have to regulate their desire rather than just regulating their usage.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. We have a question in here, Claire, that says, how can we help kids develop healthy online communication habits? I think that's a really good question because, you know, I do it with my nieces and nephews all the time. You always say please and thank you. And when we're crossing the road, you look for the fire gloss on the traffic lights. You teach kids these little things in the real world. How do we teach them how to behave in the online world from the outset? So whether it is on a FaceTime call to granny or chatting with their friends or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think that is a really good question. It's a very difficult question. And because how do we, even as adults, develop this communication with each other online? Like we were saying, that often communication that might seem harmless in real life might come across as rude or abrupt online. You know, even leaving somebody on blue tick and not answering the message can be seen as, you know, to be sending a certain message in some circumstances. So it is very difficult. So I suppose the first point is to think about whether the child is ready to be communicating like that online. Have they the maturity? Are they, you know, is it too much to expect of a young child between the ages of 8 and 12 that they would be messaging or that they would be on Snapchat? Is it more that they can handle? So I suppose looking at your child and seeing what they're able for.
Mm.
I think a lot of schools now are bringing in a bit more around, you know, digital skills, digital awareness, which is a good help as well. And a lot of schools are bringing in people to talk and send the message around online safety, but also that communication piece, that netiquette, as it's called. So I suppose it is a tricky issue. And it does come with maturity as well. As I said, it's hard even for adults to navigate the digital space.
Yeah.
So how do we expect an 8 to 12 year old to do so? And I suppose I'd start small and simple and maybe keep the communication small and simple as well in terms of what content they're allowed access and what they're allowed to do online. Mm.
Because it is something that, you know, aside from just the pressure of replying to messages, But it is very difficult to read a message in black and white. And I'm 36 and I still do it. I'm like, oh my God, is she annoyed at me? The tone, like she used a full stop at the end of that sentence. What have I done? Yeah. And again, that's me as an adult. It can be very difficult for young people to interpret what is meant by all of this. And I think, again, looking at the results of our survey that we did, cyberbullying is a significant concern for parents here. And I don't mean this to discount anything, but how important is it to identify the difference between kids being messers and cyberbullying? And how do you as a parent not flip the lid when you see your child upset by something that came in on a device? Assessing whether it is, you know, bad intent or kids being kids.
Yeah, and cyberbullying is the same as bullying. So it would have the same kind of definitive parameters around that. But we have to distinguish what the difference between banter and bullying is. Mm. You know what I mean? And we have to understand that, especially in the primary school age group, the social awareness of what the right thing to say and the wrong thing to say is gained through making mistakes. You say the wrong thing, oh, I shouldn't have said that, I won't say that again. And so we have to allow for a little bit of cluelessness rather than assuming everything has malice, right? However, what we would say around bullying is, if you have been told that what you're saying to Jess is hurting her, and it's affecting her in a negative way, regardless of whether you think it's not her. And look, a playground is a very mixed place. You could have a child who's the youngest of five siblings, who's used to rough and tumble and headlocks and all that sort of stuff. And you have a first child who's very sensitive, and they share the same space. And where one kid is kind of grabbing you in a headlock as a kind of a friendly thing to do, the other person's interpreting that. So once you say what you're doing to Jess is hurting her, don't do it again. If that persists with the knowledge of what you're doing is hurting the other person, and there's a power imbalance involved in that, that's bullying, regardless of what. Now, children as young as that, you have to give them an opportunity to make amends and say, you did this, Jess was hurt by that, don't do it again. And they might never do it again. I would call that a kind of a misread or banter, but bullying is with the intent that knowing what I'm doing is causing harm and persisting doing it anyway. Yeah. Does that make sense? And so the idea around somebody might say a comment online or something, and you've pointed out, don't do that again, that hurt that person, and they do it a second time, there is an intention involved in that, and therefore sanction or ramifications have to happen. But we have to allow that children are inhabiting a space they are for the first time, they're awkward. Like, we've all said silly, stupid things, slipped out the wrong message. You know, we have to allow people to be able to make a mistake without, you know, coming down too heavy on them. But from the point of view of persistence with intention and knowledge, that deserves ramification for sure.
Yeah, one thing that I'm very aware of with the generation who are in primary school now is the impact of the pandemic on them. Mm. Because, you know, I was saying to someone earlier on, all of my birthday parties from when I was like 2 until 10 were in Bam Bam's in Still Oregon, and it was great, and everyone came and we were mixing and playing with each other and all the rest. And I still have core memories of being in the ball pit with friends and blowing out the candles and all that sort of stuff. There's a huge cohort of children in Ireland at the moment who don't have those experiences, don't have those social memories, don't have their identities formed by other kids their age or the rough and tumble in a playground or whatever it is. How much do we need to cut ourselves and the kids a bit of slack because of the impact of the pandemic and the lack of socialization that went on for a period of time there?
And there has to be allowances for that. And again, developmental delay, like the one thing I'm always grateful for is that the pandemic happened between the ages of 42 and 44 rather than 2 and 4, 4 and 6, 6 and 8, because the trajectory is so steep. What you miss out in that time has ramifications. And oftentimes we don't spot developmental delay until later. Until you don't spot it while it's happening, you spot it afterwards. And lots of children have really struggled to recalibrate, having missed pivotal parts of that. And it's in the social and emotional sphere that they struggle the most. We're also seeing the first group of children who didn't grow up on the road, street or green, right? So they're not getting the skill set. Most of what you've probably worked out around resilience, around conflict management, about all of that sort of stuff comes from that. Mm-hmm. You know, we have, as Jonathan Haidt says, we've moved from a play-based childhood to a screen-based childhood. And that is a significant move in terms of the childhood experience of that. Mm-hmm. So when you don't have the street green interactions, there's a social atrophy that occurs in that time. And when most children are integrating online without adult supervision and surveillance, there's way more likely to have horrendously ridiculous comments being made over and back. So we have to build allowances into the fact that the pandemic had an impact. Do you know what I mean? And I don't, maybe there's another impact on pandemic, probably more for teenagers, that there's a missing, will I tell you about that now? So children who are now in kind of fourth and fifth year in secondary school, they were part of the play date generation. So when you're in fourth, fifth and sixth class, your parents organize your social world. So Jess, you come over to Coleman and Coleman will go over to you next week. And they orchestrated that. When pandemic lifted, they were in second year and they were in masks and all that sort of stuff. But when it truly lifted, they were way too cool to do play dates. They can't ask their mom, can you ask Tom to come over to my house?
Yeah.
And so they missed out on the social architecture of organizing your social world. And I see so many of those boys in my therapy room who would love social contact. They would love to meet up with their pals, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know what to do. And I think, what will they, if I ask my friend over, what will we do? We just hang out. Oh, we couldn't do that. You know what I mean? And so there's loads of these lonely boys who are not able to connect. The only way in which they can connect is through the headset and through the gaming issue. Do you know what I mean? But I've no doubt that if those same boys were playing on their games inside and their friends were out on the green, that they'd choose to go out to the green rather than do it through the headset. Does that make sense? And so that pandemic cost in their development, they still haven't gotten it back.
And I think that's what some parents of this age cohort are concerned, because they're seeing that maybe they have older children and they see the teenagers not go out on the green and play football. They see them all chatting on the headsets or just messaging. And I suppose that brings us back to this age of cohort in that, how do we ensure that we're not repeating that for the current generation? Because it's a very easy pattern to fall into of, I should just go in there and watch your big brother playing on the PlayStation for a while.
Yeah, I think it's about giving children an opportunity to practice those social skills. Right? Mm-hmm. There's a brilliant study done in UCD a few years ago for the COVID children who came back into primary school, and they could count to 100 and knew all their colours, but they couldn't say hello to each other and they couldn't put their chair under the desk when they should have, and they couldn't open their lunch boxes. Right?
Yeah.
So the skills that we're developing, there's an opportunity cost. The more time you spend in your room on your device doing something, there's something you're not doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And for us as parents, we have to value, and there's a bigger situation here around child safety, right? A lot of parents who are in the room here now probably came through an era of the 90s, right, where we had Fearn's reports and all this sort of stuff around child abuse and all that sort of stuff. So we grew up with a very vigilant child safety issue. The Madeleine McCann globally changed how we see child looking after children, child care.
Yeah.
So as a consequence of that, the internet came out at the same time and said, you can show your kid the world and have them in their box room so they don't leave the house and they're safe. And we were the parents who bought into that idea of they're safe because they're here. Do you know what I mean? I was one of the latchkey kids. I went off on a bike at 9 o'clock in the morning, came back at 9 o'clock at night. It's the most character building, wonderful experience I ever had. I do not allow my children to do that. Do you know what I mean? Something that, and because my own experience is that through that time, I've become so much more sensitive to the idea. What I'd be saying to parents is they need to do that. You need to have your children playing with other children in that space, because it's the thing that'll get them off the device. It's not about you have to sell real life connection. You have to sell the idea. And that if that means having kids over to your house more often, do that. You know, bring them over and say, no screens, just play. And the more opportunity they have, the more capacity they have to develop mental fitness. And the mental fitness is that resilience, conflict resolution, being able to hold conversations, being able to tell a story, being able to listen. Children who can do that will develop into resilient teenagers and resilient young adults. If we don't give them the opportunity to develop that, they're not going to. It's not going to happen innately. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think it's finding that opportunity. And I know friends of mine who are parents, Claire, and they know this stuff logically, but they also have full-time jobs and they have the guilt and they have their own phones and maybe they have a parent that needs looking after. So they're having to liaise with siblings on WhatsApp groups. And I think there's a huge sense of guilt, most of it unjustified, on a lot of parents. So how do parents firstly cut some slack, but also bite the bullet and stick with this modelling of thought, not completely removing devices, but incentivising the play, the human connection, and encouraging it.
Yeah, and it is since COVID, you've seen this even more reliance on devices. So even for homework, for a lot of time during COVID and even post-COVID, the homework was going home via an iPad.
Yeah.
So your child is coming in from school, sitting in front of an iPad, doing the homework on the iPad, and then stays on the iPad, post the homework, and you're trying to get them off the iPad. You know, so that reliance on technology, and of course, some children were doing their lessons through technology even during COVID. So we just became this technology focused communities around Ireland, which was, you know, as Conor was saying, it's an awful loss then in terms of the non-technology spaces. And as you say, parents are working. A lot of parents now are able to work from home. And as their children grow up a bit, the children can come home from school and be there while the parent is working. And often that requires quiet, concentration. Where do the children go? They do their homework and then what? You know, it's the screens. So I think it is, you're right, we do have to cut ourselves a little bit of slack. I think there's an awful lot around, you know, maybe setting agreements in advance. When you come in from school, this is what you do. You know, take off the uniform, have a snack, do your homework, and then we'll talk. Then we'll see if there's time for a game or if there's time to, you know, to watch something on YouTube. But it is putting in place, I suppose, that balance, and it's always important in anything we do, is that bit of balance during the week that the child can play, go outside, do their sport, but also if they get a little bit of screen time as well, that it is balanced with everything else.
There's another question in here, Coleman, and it kind of sums up what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. My child's friends have set up a WhatsApp group without her. She's devastated. How can I help? And that's something that, it seems so trivial, but again, if you place yourself in those shoes, it could be just heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's not trivial at all. To a young child, that's devastation. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That is, they're being socially orchestratedly excluded. And that's, you know that's not by accident, you know. And again, we talk about gaming, and for males, it's oftentimes about agency and about power and shooting how many people you can get your numbers up and stuff like that. For girls, it's usually it's about communion and connection with other people. And so anything that symbolizes that you're not doing that well or you're not doing that well enough is a devastation to their character, right? So orchestrated exclusion is by far the biggest threat we have to the mental health of young girls in Ireland and in secondary school and first year. It's a really difficult one to manage because it's very difficult to prove. You know, Jessica, you have to play with so-and-so or whatever the case may be. And so with those difficulties, we have to do something about it. I don't have the answers to that. Mm-hmm. I sometimes believe it's maybe addressing the parents of the excluder and saying, like, if I knew my kid was doing that, I would be on it. Do you know what I mean? But the amount of pollination of impact that has across a year or a class or whatever the case may be can really have a damaging impact. What I'd say for that parent is you're trying to show your child that they still have value and still have worth. They need to find their tribe somewhere. Mm-hmm. And if this is not your tribe, now the problem with this is she'll probably be re-added to that group next week and some other kid will get excluded off it. Do you know what I mean?
They're so fickle there at is, that age,
it's
yeah.
so changeable. And so it's not about having a kind of catastrophic reaction to it, but your child's self-belief, self-worth and self-value are the three pillars that will keep them well. And when there's a threat to that by somebody else, you're trying to replace or replenish that sense of self-worth, self-value. Maybe the tribe is in scouts. Maybe it's in your dance group. Maybe it's with your cousins, whatever it might be. Get her around those people who remind her of her value, not the people who take her value from her. And that's as much as you can do. I know it feels like pouring water into a leaking bucket as a parent when you're doing that. But it's what you need to do in order to sustain her through this period. This will pass. You know, I would, 99% of cases, these things are transient and temporary. Mm-hmm. But from the point of view of that parent, there's nothing more heartbreaking than watching your child be excluded like that. It's very difficult.
No, and I have seen an example of this in my own life where one of the young people in my life wasn't in the little group that do the TikTok dances in the yard. And they shouldn't be on phones, firstly, but this little person was telling me that she wasn't allowed to do the TikTok dances and she was gutted about it because she'd see them all going over to do it and she'd be actively excluded. And it's so much more than the act itself. It's the not you. This is our tribe and not you. And that can knock a young girl's self-esteem. And if young girls are already online at that age and they're seeing, you know, a sort of image of life and a perception of life being portrayed on social media, and then they're not fitting in with whatever school group that they want to, that can be a very difficult thing for you as a parent to sit by and watch happen.
It's incredibly, and it's incredibly difficult, and the powerlessness of it is really difficult. One of the things as a parent that you almost have to surrender your powerless towards is your child's choice of friendships or your child's friendships. It's not something that you have control over, and it's not something you can orchestrate. So what you need to do is, rather than trying to work with the dynamics of that group, is really concentrate your efforts on working with your child and trying to keep her as together as possible within that context. I know you're looking at me that sounds...
I agree, but I just wonder, can you teach resilience? Like, without it being a sit down here and you're going to be the, say I'm the best girline in front of the mirror 10 times. Like, how do you teach? Because I was a super anxious child, and I remember my mum sitting me down. I didn't want to do Irish dancing, and she'd sit me down and she'd be like, Jessica, it's a good thing to do. Jessica, you should go to do it. Mm. And I'd be sitting there going, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I don't want to go. And so I'm just wondering, is there some magic wand for parents to, you know, build up the resilience and tell the child that they're loved and give them the confidence to just give the proverbial two fingers to, not actual, but proverbial to the kids who are excluding them?
No, there's not. Aww. I mean, I think we get it wrong a lot of the time when we're talking about, we say to children, you know, but you're a great hurler and you're great at maths and you're great at this. And we try and that's not.
You're missing the point.
It doesn't work. Yeah, that's like, you know, you're talking about accolades and their achievements. It's about you're kind, you're generous, you're brave. Those internal qualities that I don't have to provide a prize for. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view of that. And it's, the resilience comes from a knowledge of who I am and who I'm not. I'll show you an example. So let's say there's a kid, Mary and Anne, right? And their friend Sophie walks past. Mm. And Mary says, hi, Sophie. And Sophie ignores her. And Anne says, hi, Sophie. And Sophie ignores her. And Mary spends the next 7 hours ruminating. What did I do to upset Sophie? Why does she not like me? What did I send the wrong message? Anne, on the other hand, says, screw you, Sophie, and gets on with her day. Mm. The difference between Mary and Anne is a sense of self. Who I am, and more importantly, who I'm not, right?
Yeah.
So the idea around what you're trying to do in building resilience is building that sense of who you are, what your value is, not how many prizes you have, not how many grades you get, but who you are as a person, and honing in on those qualities. Because if you know your strengths and your limitations, that makes you as resilient as possible in terms of, I know what to get upset about, which are the important things, but I'm not going to sweat the small stuff.
Mm.
And if you can develop that within a child, then they're resilient both in the online and offline space.
Yeah, which is so important. Claire, there's another question in here, and I think this is something that CyberSafe has been excellent at highlighting in the last few years. Are the tech companies doing anything to help parents? How are they allowed to continue to target children with questionable content?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good question. It's the golden question, really. I suppose what we could say is that the law has changed and that we now have legal obligation on platforms to regulate their content. In Ireland, we've had the Online Safety Code came out in October, and it talks about how platforms now have certain responsibilities about age-inappropriate content, how that is managed and how the platforms identify the age of the user isn't clear, but those obligations are there. Then via Europe, we have the Digital Services Act. This talks a little bit more about algorithms and about illegal content. Whereas the Irish Act, we were hoping, was a bit more about harmful content. Europe talks about illegal content. So you'd hope that some of what the child is being exposed to via the algorithm in their feed is somewhat ameliorated by that legislation. Whether people on the ground are seeing changes or not, I'm not hearing that there has been massive changes with all this legislation. Like, we saw the European Parliament last week, a committee group had voted in an addendum or an addition to the Digital Services Act, which looks to a delay in social media under the age of 13, and then 13 to 16, you'd require parental consent before a child could be on social media. So there is more changes afoot. We see in Australia, they're bringing in a delay until the child is 16, and that's coming in the 10th of December. They've done a huge technological trial around age verification methods. So they've established what kind of technology is there to verify the age of the users, and then children under 16 are not allowed on the platforms. So across the globe, there is responses to the harms that are coming in that children are facing. Is it quick enough? Is it fast enough? Are we seeing changes on the ground? I don't really think we're seeing actual tangible changes. I don't think that it's coming fast enough. We heard when the Online Safety and Media Regulation Act came in that there was going to be an independent complaints mechanism. So a way that parents could contact the regulator and identify harmful content and get assistance around the bullying issues and the issues that are not illegal but are harmful and are harming children. And hopefully that will be up and running in a few years' time. There is a similar type methodology for illegal content, but often what's becoming more and more problematic for children is that harmful content, the content that isn't illegal, but is harmful and is causing harm to children.
Yeah, and I think it is great. These are all stepping stones towards, you know, hopefully a safer internet for everybody and in particular our younger people. But as you said, a lot of this isn't going to be up and running and we won't necessarily feel the impact of it for a while yet. So we are up against the clock, and if there are any questions in the room, you might throw your hand up. But while you do that, Coleman, I want to ask you, for parents whose kids already have access to technology and perhaps they didn't have the conversation with them before handing the device over, what's a good way to have a, if you see something that upsets you, scares you, you're unsure of, come to me conversation, without terrifying them and without saying, you are going to see bad things, you must tell me when you see them, because it's not a guarantee.
No, it's not. I think, and I say this, I've been saying this for years, and it's amazing how people don't have this conversation. Most important conversation you can have with your child tonight is go home and say, whatever it is you come across online that you're uncomfortable with, you tell me. And I guarantee you it will mean that I won't take the device off you, right? I give you my word, shake on it, right? Because children who are coming across material that they don't, they, no parent gives a child a phone and says, welcome to the world, have a good time. We hand it over with trepidation. And the trepidation is picked up by the child and they're going, I'll be fine, I'll be grand, I'll walk the dog and pick up the poo. They never do it, but they'll promise it when it happens. The issue being that when something comes up, the last thing a child wants to see is the I told you so face or I knew it. Or so they won't tell you anything for fear that that's the case.
Yeah.
When you say, tell me whatever it is, I will not take the device off you and we will work it out. I've got your back here. I know there's a risk of this happening. I know it won't always be your fault. You may stumble upon this, but come to me. When I say to you, it's not working with the device, it's working with the child. You know, you work with your child to be able to be a good decision maker, to make the sensible choice, to be able to come to you. If you can establish that, and that conversation will be the most important tech conversation you will have, because at least then when they come to you, you can resolve it. If they're struggling with it on their own, you know, do you want your child to learn how to drive while you're in the passenger seat or when you're on a weekend away? Do you know what I mean? The issue is you want it when you're in the passenger seat. And so for me, that's how you get that buy-in, is by making that. And that's a pledge. Kids make all these pledges about what they'll do and what they won't do. As a parent, I pledge not to take the phone off you. We'll work it out.
Yeah, that was Coleman Nochter and Claire Daly speaking with me at a Behind the Screens event in Cork last month. I would love to know your thoughts. You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. And don't forget, you can listen to the first two parts from this series on the Go Loud app. Just search for Tech Talk. John Fardy is going to be up here next on News Talk in just a quick minute. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.
Hi there, it's News Talk's Andrea Gilligan here. We talk a lot about health, but your gut is where it all begins. A balanced gut can improve everything from your digestion and energy to your immune system and even your mood. That's why Simproof, Ireland's number one for gut health, is such a game changer. And right now, for Black Friday, you can get 25% off their live and active bacteria supplement. Each daily shot is packed with billions of friendly bacteria that actually reach your gut alive and start working to restore balance where it matters most. No capsules, no powders, just a refreshing, water-based drink in four great flavours. Take it first thing each morning, 10 minutes before food or drink, and start feeling the difference. A healthy gut supports your whole body, so don't miss 25% off Simproof's 12 and 4-week programmes now at simproof.ie. Now, enjoy the podcast.